come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
Welcome, listeners, to episode 229 of Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here, David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. So in this episode here for you is going to be my Centennial Club number 15. My old movie that I'm going to be covering here is going to be Dante's Inferno from 1924. Different little take that we have there for that. And I actually got to go to the Gateway Film Center to check out Immaculate on its opening night. And recording this is one of the last reviews that I had to do here. So this actually makes for an interesting double feature, as we're almost dealing with, it's a religious double feature, kind of looking at it now. We have Dante's Inferno going to hell, and then Immaculate is dealing in a convent where we could have a nun being, you know, impregnated without actually having intercourse. So then, going along with that, mini reviews, I have my Foray to the Forest rewatch is Blood for Dracula, and then I have a bunch of screeners that I got to watch for this week of Easter Bloody Easter, Dr. Jekyll. This came out in 2023, but getting its wide release here this year in America, and then Everwinter Night. And then I also got to see The Crawlers. This is one that has been on my list due to, I'll get into it why. And then I also have a screener for The Short of Velma, and then another episode of The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Lived. So I don't think there's anything else I need to get you up to speed here for this intro. So what I will say is thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me.
Journey with a Cinephile.
And my first mini review here is going to be Blood for Dracula. This also goes by Andy Warhol's Dracula. This is from 1974, directed by Paul Morrissey. Now, this is also written by him. And then it looks like Pat Hackett helped out here, and then I think that was uncredited work, and then there's also uncredited giving credit to, that's kind of confusing, to Bram Stoker for writing the novel. And then this stars Joe D'Alessandro, Udo Kier, and Vittorio De Sica. This is a horror film that is from a co-production of Italy, France, and the United States, currently sitting on a 6.1 on IMDb and a 3.2 on Letterboxd, or synopsis being, an alien vampire count travels to Italy with his servant to find a bride. So this is the film that I had learned about thanks to the Horror Show Guide Encyclopedia that I'm working through, as of course they were crediting this as Andy Warhol's Dracula, and it took some research on my end to go by that I realized that the easier title to find is Blood for Dracula. I had seen this movie years ago, so I'm now giving it a rewatch as my foray through the fours. And where I'm going to start jumping in is that, actually let me give you a little bit more backstory here. Udo Kier is taking on the role of Count Dracula. Now, he has a servant of Anton portrayed by Arno Jürgen, and these guys both appeared in Flesh for Frankenstein, which is Andy Warhol's Frankenstein that I covered last year. So, now, he needs, these vampires need to have, well, Anton is not a vampire, but Count Dracula, of course, being is, and they need to have the blood of virgins to survive in this, and if you give them tainted blood, it makes them sick. So, they travel to Italy looking for virginal bride for Dracula, as in Romania they don't have anybody left that will fit this need. So they end up living and trying to marry one of the daughters of the Marquis, and then obviously his wife of the Marquise. Now, the Marquis is De Sica, and then Maxime McKendry is taking on the Marquis S. And they have four daughters of Esmeralda, portrayed by Melina Vukotic, Saphiria, who's portrayed by Dominique Darrell, Rubina, portrayed by Stefania Cassini, and Perla, portrayed by Silvania Dionisio. I think that's how you pronounce that. If I mispronounce any of those, I do apologize. And I should say Cassini is from Suspiria, which I just now clicked at this time around watching it. So this is an interesting movie. Despite its, you know, cult status, it's still well made. It does come with issues which seem to be more budgetary. There are social messages that are underneath the surface that I didn't remember from the other time seeing this. So I'm glad, and this is the reason why I revisit movies like this. Where I want to start is that Count Dracula and a Servant of Anton. I like this sets the idea that the vampires need to have virginal blood. This is a hilarious line in the movie, is how the blood of these whores is killing the Count. The Marquise is either delusional that Saphiria and Rubina are virgins, or she's just naive. It could be the latter, since the only male that could taint their purity would be Mario, portrayed by D'Alessandro. I'm not sure why she wouldn't believe that he would. Now, for me, since there are so many vampire films out there, I'm a fan we do something a bit different. We get the idea here with the idea that the variation on this creature needing virginal blood. Esmeralda isn't selected because she was engaged to be married and that fell through. That makes our Count believe that she wouldn't be a viable option. Perla is too young to be married, and we see that the blood, when it's tainted, it makes Dracula sick, and I like that concept. And actually, when he shows up here, because he hasn't fed for so long, they're playing on this idea that it's almost like a drug or addiction. So I kind of like using that, even though this movie is a little bit fuzzy on when it's taking place. So then shifting from that, let me delve into this family then. There are vibes of House of Usher from Edgar Allan Poe here. The family was once proud and rich. They are clinging to the former despite the Marquise having gambled their money away. It is fitting that Saphiria and Rubina are free spirits. They expose themselves from the opening sequence with them. And they're also engaging in incest while they're fornicating with Mario. This seems to be borrowing from when this was made in the 1970s and incorporating it into the past. It works for me, though. As his family is losing their prestige, we see that their daughters are given into lust and decadence. Falls in line with their family, or their father, gambling everything away. I also want to explore the concept of Mario and his beliefs. Now, he's a socialist. He is convinced that all the aristocrats are on their way out. Despite working for this family, he mocks them. He knows they're broke, and it's just a matter of time. I agree with him about workers needing to rise up. Now, my problem is that he's rude and violent towards the women, and it makes me despise him. He's supposed to be our hero, but I don't like him. How rough he is a issue. His political beliefs makes him hate the Count, which I did like. So that should be enough for the story, so let's go over to the acting. The anger towards the class system we get from D'Alessandro is good. I just don't like his character as a person outside of that. Kira is good as a sickly vampire. De Sica is fine as his minor role as the Marquise. I did like McKendry and what she is pushing to save her family. She is auctioning off her daughters, which seems like something that royalty would do. Jürgen is good as this familiar for the Dracula who is trying to save him. He doesn't have any power that's given by his role, but he does know how to work the system. Vujatic and Dionysi are good as the reserved daughters. Darrell and Cassini are both solid as the two who are like modern women. We see both nude, which is nice. It's interesting since the latter was in Suspiria, and I never connected that until this watch. Other than that, I thought the rest of the cast rounded off for what was needed. All that's left is filmmaking. What shocked me about this one is how well this was made for the budget. First, I need to say this is an art house film. Capturing what they can for the setting was in the past is good. I love the castles that are used. Dracula and Anton arrive in a car. What is funny here is that this seems to be a modern setting, but the use of royalty gives it that timeless feel. The effects we get are solid. I did have an issue with the lack of like more blood spray, but it makes sense now that I was reflecting on it. What we got worked. I love how sickly they make Dracula look. What is interesting is things that were done with the cinematography, one of which is using a wheelchair while holding the camera to simulate what Dracula is seeing since he's in a wheelchair when he's talking to everybody. That was good. Other than that, the soundtrack fit for what was needed. In conclusion, this is a movie that I'm glad I revisited. It is better than I remembered. There is some stiff dialogue here and there. It doesn't ruin it. I like what they're doing with the vampire and the character of Dracula. There's also some good social commentary here about promiscuity, being virginal, and about workers revolting against the rich. The acting is solid. I like seeing a young Kier. This is well made. There are some minor issues with effects, but nothing to ruin this. And I mean, there's also a little bit of budgetary things, but again, not one that I can recommend to everybody, but this is more of an art house film, and it's an interesting watch to fans of Dracula, vampires, or just movies of this era. So my rating here the second time around for Blood for Dracula is going to be a 7 out of 10. And for my second mini review is going to be Easter Bloody Easter. This is from 2024. This is directed by Diane Foster. It was written by Allison Lobel. Now, Foster stars in this with Cary Grant and Lobel. This is a horror film that is from the United States. Now, it's not available to be rated yet on the IMDb page, and on Letterboxd, there's not enough ratings as of yet. So, synopsis, a woman must protect her small town from the jackalope and his devilish army of bunnies as they embark on a murder spree over the Easter weekend. So, kind of a wild movie if you can't tell. So this is one I got the chance to see via a screener thanks to Justin Cook. Now, the title made me think of Christmas, Bloody Christmas, so I wouldn't be shocked to learn that they're playing off of that. So seeing this was an Easter horror movie and reading the press release, I decided to give it a watch. It also doesn't hurt that this is a 2024 release either, so, you know, there is also that. So I want to start is that this is fun, and you're not supposed to take it seriously. There are comedic elements used throughout. When the jackalope controls rabbits, they're stuffed animals with glowing eyes. What I do like, though, is that there are some serious aspects here as well. While watching this, it struck me that this is a combination of Jaws meeting Silver Bullet. So let's start delving in a little bit more into what we're getting. This takes place in a small town in Texas. That makes sense with how religious these people are, being in the Bible Belt. What I love there is it's poking fun at religious people and how they're violating their own religion. We have Mary Lou, who is lustful towards Lance. Now, Mary Lou is portrayed by Lobel, and then Lance is by DeAndre Noir. Should say that Lance is married to Janine Cooper, who is portrayed by Foster. And then I would also say Mary Lou is prideful after everything she's doing here for this celebration. Now, the minister of the town is drinking. They also have murders happening, and they won't postpone the events. This is where it feels like Jaws, where this town won't shut down the beaches despite it leading to more attacks. It is putting people together so the jackalope can attack, you know, everybody. I also find it hilarious what this monster is here. My first introduction to this animal was through my uncle, who likes to see how far he can run with a joke. He has a rabbit with antlers mounted on it on his wall, and he tried to get me to believe that it was real. I like the backstory that we learn where the original attacks were done by a person who made a deal with Satan to ensure that the Easter events happened. Kind of ironic. In turn, this changed them into this beast. They went practical with the look for the most part. I do like that the antlers are used in at least one attack sequence. This shifts to being Silver Bullet here where the character of Megan, who is portrayed by Ziri Starks, now, she has a rabbit's foot on her necklace, so she's actually not, she hasn't killed one, but she has injured it enough to get its foot, and she claimed that it was from the jackalope. This gives Janine the idea that they're looking for someone missing a foot. We learn that a limb is removed from a jackalope, it can regenerate it. It would take time to grow back, though, so it almost makes you think of, like, Deadpool, where he loses his legs, and we get to see how, like, they're tiny as they're growing back and everything and regenerating. And that also makes me think of Silver Bullet, where the werewolf in that movie kind of plays into how they figured out who it is. This doesn't necessarily pay off like I would have hoped, but I still like the progression of the story elements with it. Then to finish out my thoughts on the story, I thought that this was fine what they do there. My problem with pulling filmmaking is this runs too long. I saw it was 105 minutes. About 8 of those are credits, so bringing that closer to an hour and a half. I think this would have been better served if we came in at 80. There are a few scenes where a band or someone is singing that I don't know if we need. This hooks me with the opening kill, and then I'm there for the mystery. The problem is that the climax takes too long to get to it. I just think trimming it would have helped run it a bit tighter, in my opinion. So let's go over the rest of the filmmaking. The cinematography is fine here. They do well to hide things when it comes to practical effects, which work. I did find it funny that all the normal rabbits that are being controlled are stuffed ones with glowing eyes. We get decent gore from attacks done by the jackalope. I did like the practical approach to the monster. My only issue would be the effects come from the use of, like, blood spray with CGI. I'm not a fan there. Other than that, the soundtrack was fine. There's this live band that has plays a couple different songs that fit for what was needed. We also get Foster singing late in the movie, and she has a good voice. All that's left would be acting. What works here are the characters being suspicious or creepy that made me think they could be the creature. Since it's a shapeshifter, that would make sense. Foster is good as our lead. She turns to drinking to cope with her husband leaving, which in turn causes her to black out and not remember things. This could make her the jackalope. Grant is good as her friend. Lobel is great as this church-going woman who doesn't fully follow the religion. I did like that she wrote this, and it's intentional for the character, I believe. Starks is good as this hunter of the creature. I would also say that Noir, Zach Cannor, Miles Cooper, Gavin K. Lee, Adam Slemon, J.B. B. Klein as the jackalope was good there. I also wanted to give credit. There's one other person here. Caitlin Oden and the rest of the cast around the software was needed. Once again, credit to Klein for being inside of the jackalope costume. So in conclusion, I not necessarily target audience here. That's not to say I didn't have a good time, though. This does well in bringing the horror while blending it with the comedy. I'm just not the biggest fan there, since I think we get too much of the latter. I did like the mythology introduced. It does well in sticking to it as well, especially when where things end up. The acting was solid in bringing the characters to life. This is made well enough. I'm not going to harp there, since this is working with a lower budget. Using stuffed rabbits was funny. The look of the jackalope was good. It's on the cheap side, but there's charm to it being practical. Not one that I can recommend to everybody. You need to enjoy comedy horror, but this is one to watch with drinks or if you're into like lower budget stuff. So my rating here for Easter Bloody Easter is going to be a 5 out of 10. Then up next, I have another screener here of Dr. Jekyll from 2023. This is directed by Joe Stevenson, written by Dan Kelly Mulhern, while also giving credit to Robert Louis Stevenson for the original novella. This stars as Eddie Izzard, Scott Chambers, and Lindsay Duncan. This is a drama horror mystery film that is from the United Kingdom. It's actually a newer Hammer production. And it is sitting on a 5.0 on IMDb and a 3.2 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being a modern reimagining of the infamous Dr. Jekyll. Should say that is being portrayed by Izzard. So this is a movie that got the chance to see thanks to Keir Waller from Strike Media, who sent over a screener. What caught my interest was that this was a Hammer film. They're a studio that I sought out after watching the original Universal Classic monster movies. This is one where they're doing a modern take on a classic story now that they're back making features. I had heard about this one being made, so that helped as well when I got the chance to check this out. So where I want to start then is that we have an interesting move to use the transgender actor Izzard for the titular character as well as the alter ego. For me, I don't have any issues there. This isn't the first time this idea has been used. Hammer made Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde in 1971. I also remember Dr. Jekyll and Miss Hyde from 1995, where the doctor changes into a woman. We get something a bit different from what we've seen, though, as we have Izzard playing both Jekyll and Hyde as women characters. So I want to start would be the character of Rob, though. This would not be, you know, the main character here. This is Scott Chambers taking on the character of Rob. I felt for him as the more that we learn. Originally, I thought he was just a slacker who needs a job. Seeing how appreciative it is towards his brother for getting him the interview made me smile. His brother is Ewan, portrayed by Morgan Watkins. We learn that he's an ex-con. That would be Rob. He needs a job to show the courts and the government to get to see his child. They've never met. This made me tear up because the baby was born while he was in prison. I root for him there. Then seeing Mauve is pushing and trying to do drives tension as she doesn't want him to see the girl. She's portrayed by Robin Cara. It all culminates with Nina wanting to help, and this would be Nina Jekyll. That he isn't always sure who he's talking to there, Jekyll or Hyde. Chambers does good in this role, so credit to him. So next up, she'll be discussing Izzard and taking on these dual roles. What is interesting here is that she plays Hyde subtly to the point where I didn't necessarily know until later that is who she was. That makes it scarier where it ends up. I'm not overly familiar with her stand-up specials, but I've seen her periodically in films. She is talented and that comedic timing works well here. Izzard seems like this brilliant doctor who has run into an issue. The more we see, the more devious it becomes when we get to learn their endgame. I didn't fully appreciate this until the end once all the reveals are done. Something else I should say is that this is a contained film. Once we get to the estate, Rob goes out a couple of times. Then when we're at the resolution, it isn't even in the manor, but it's mostly Nina and Rob interacting with the characters of like Sandra, portrayed by Lindsay Duncan, Mauve, and Ewan influencing them. There is a backstory introduced with Jonathan Hyde and Isabella Inchbald as well, as I believe they are the parents to Dr. Jekyll. This is a much different take than others that I've seen, and I end up appreciating that, as the setting has room both inside and out, so that adds as well. So let's go over to the acting, and let me finish out there since I've already started. I've already said that Izzard and Chambers were both good. I like Duncan and what her role does to the self-esteem of Rob. She stands as the outside world and how they view ex-criminals. Kara is good as this one who's trying to potentially ruin Rob's life and pull him back into committing crimes. Not directly, but he would be suspected. Watkins is good as well in his smaller role. Credit here to Hyde, Simon Callow, Tony Jawarden, and Inchbald as well. All that's left in his filmmaking, I've already said that the setting being isolated like it is solid. What is good there is that it isn't too far out of town though either. The cinematography was good to capture where they're setting it and make it feel claustrophobic. They also have limited effects at times where they frame it to hide the seams. No issues there. I did have a problem with Jekyll and Hyde seeming to not be all that different. There is a reveal there that concludes that clears that up for me. The latter is more like a figurative monster than a literal one, like movies in the past or the source material. Other than that, I thought the soundtrack fit for what was needed. In conclusion, it's a bit different from the versions that I've seen in the past. And I've seen a few like this, though. I like that Izzard is making both Jekyll and Hyde as women. There's a subtle performance there that makes sense in the reveal, and I appreciate that. Chambers also does well as his ex-con character and how it fits in the narrative. This is made well enough. No glaring issues there. The best part are the isolated, contained setting as well as the cinematography. Not sure that I can recommend this to everybody. This is an unconventional take on the source material that I appreciated. If you like Izzard's acting or want to see like a different take there, then I'd recommend this to you. My rating here for Dr. Jekyll, then, is going to be a 7 out of 10. And another screener I got to check out, Everwinter Night. This is from 2023, and I believe it's getting its wide release here this year. But this is directed by Adam Newman, who also co-wrote this with Chris Goodwin. This stars Sarah Nicklin, Francesca Shipsey, and Victoria Mirror. This is a comedy horror film that is from the United States, currently sitting on a 6.7 on IMDb, and not enough ratings on Letterboxd, but I would say probably about a 3-star movie over there. With the synopsis being, lifelong best friends Maddie and V set out for a relaxing vacation. When their old college clique hijacks their plans, V finds herself at a remote ski lodge where a group of mysterious wealthy men throw a celebration a century in the making. So I should say here, V is portrayed by Mirror, and her friend Maddie is portrayed by McKenna Parsons. Now, the friends that they're referring to are actually Maddie's friends. It's Fiona, portrayed by Nicoletta Sweeney, and Alana Phillips, portrayed by Becca. So this is the one I got the chance to see thanks to Alex DiVincenzo from Simply Legendary Publicity, who sent over a screener. When I glanced at this, I was making sure that it was horror, and that was enough for me to check out. This one took a bit of research to find out that it had 2 showings in 2023, so I would consider to say Traverse of the Threes because of that. But this is getting its wide release for this year's eligibility with everything that I've seen outside of that, so it's also going to be on my 2024 new horror movies watch list. So I want to start then from there is the build-up and setting. We have an isolated lodge. It is in the New England area during the winter, so it'd be difficult to leave without a vehicle. It's also cold. We don't feel that unless the characters head outside, but this is still looming when they do. There is also the idea that this group is hosting a party that is rich and powerful, which is scary when you aren't part of the group. That works well here as we have Becca and Fiona pushing it. They see free drinks, food, guys that they can hit on. Maddie gets sucked in with her attraction to the character of Eric, portrayed by Goodwin. It is only V who is taking a step back and seeing where the horror builds. She is our representation of what is happening. Where I want to go from there is that this is a slow burn. I'd say it's a bit too slow for my liking. What is interesting, though, is I get sucked into what the characters are doing. I'll be honest, though. This could be trimmed down to 1.5 hours. I think it's running at like 1 hour and 45 minutes. If it does that, it works better. This falls too much with like comedic elements with Fiona, Tony, Becca, and the guy she is flirting with. There's also this reoccurring guy who hits on V. The better lighthearted moments come from like Maddie and V when they sit down to talk. Also the women interacting with Eric and the Jack, who is the bartender here. And he's also the son of the owner. Should say Jack being Jamie Dufault. And then his father is Harold, portrayed by Johnny Halloran. I think that we need a bit more horror and a bit less of the banter for this to build the necessary atmosphere. So going over the horror though, I'm there. We have this group of rich guys who are a cult. From the opening sequence, we know that they're doing a ritual. What this does is it takes time to be revealed. There's some strategic as well to give information as we fill in the backstory. There were little things that get said that I picked up on that these guys might be living longer than normal lives. Also, there's this odd scene where Fiona pours her heart out, and what Tony does is shocking. This also gets explained why. I wanted to give credit here to that aspect that kept my interest the pieces together. Let's go over to the acting then. Thought that Mira was good as our lead. What I like about her is that she's reserved. She makes comments about Maddie and Jack, which, to be honest, made me like her more. The older I get, the more I'm like her. She's also cute. Parsons is good as her friend who is trying to have fun while also not upset her friend. They've grown apart in life while still clinging to being friends. Like, they're really close to just ending this relationship. They don't even realize it. So I also like Sarah Nicklin and Shipsy, along with Sweeney and Phillips, as they're good as these other women at the lodge. Goodwin is good as the leader of the cult. I thought that the other members were solid. I don't know all their names, but watching them, they all bring different things to their characters, so that works. I also like Dufault. Him and V play well off each other. The acting here is good across the board. My only issue would be at times it feel like they went too comedic, which turns this into an oddball comedy. Not sure if that fits ultimately where it goes. All that's left in his filmmaking, although the cinematography was good, they capture the feeling of this isolated location. The cold helps to build the atmosphere there. This does have a bit cheaper look, but this probably just being low budget and shot digital. No glaring issues there. I thought that this had some, you know, effects that we got were subdued. That's fine, since it's more about the concept and the atmosphere. We got some CGI that wasn't an issue for me, other than I thought the soundtrack fit for what was needed. So in conclusion, this is a movie that I should love. It has concepts that work for me, like a cult doing a ritual. There's also good backstory that gets revealed as this goes on. You could even consider this to have elements of, like, cosmic horror. The isolated setting, with it being in the winter, was good. The acting, for the most part, was solid. There are times, though, where it goes a bit too comedic for my liking. This is well made, though. The cinematography leading the way there. The biggest issue is that it runs too long, and it's just a bit too slow to fully capture what they need here. Still, I'd recommend this if you like the aspects that I said being a positive for you. So my rating here for Ever Winter Night is going to be a 6 out of 10. And the last feature that I'm going to be covering here for this episode, for the mini-reviews, is going to be The Crawlers, a.k.a. Contamination 0.7. This is from 1990, directed by Fabrizio Laurenti, and it looks like Joe D'Amato did some uncredited work as well. This is written officially by Albert Lawrence and Daniele Stropa, but we also have some uncredited work by D'Amato for the story, and then Rossella Drudi and Fabrizio Laurenti also did some work there. This is starring Mary Sellers, Josh Saucier, and Bubba Reeves. This is a horror sci-fi thriller film that is a co-production between Italy and Canada, currently sitting on a 2.9 on IMDb and a 2.1 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis being, people from a small town are attacked by evil radioactive tree roots growing in the forest. So this is one I learned about when getting into horror movie podcasts. It's one that I saw the titles for it, and that intrigued me. I then saw the ratings and went low on a list of ones to check out. I have done this now because it's loosely considered Troll 3. This is completing the franchise according to Letterboxd. Other than that, I just went into this one blind. So where I want to start then is that we have a good message that is veiled underneath what we're getting. Not the first to explore this idea, but I'm also not shocked to see D'Amato and Drudi were involved. The latter, since they did uncredited work with writing Troll 2, it would make sense with the Italian marketing to try to play this off of the sequel there. So now that I have that set up, let's delve into this one. Where I want to start then is that we have a decent thing that it starts with. We have the character of Josie, portrayed by Sellers, coming to the area that she's from. You know, she's returning home. She went to the big city to finish high school. She hasn't been back in years. It is here that she's to see her mother, who I believe is going to be Denise, portrayed by Carol Croft. And then her little brother is David, who is portrayed by Kevin Croft. Now, Matt still loves her, and that was her ex that she is leaving behind of Saucier. He still loves her and wants to get back together. They feel like a couple that knows each other as they bicker over little things. Their relationship's also a bit toxic due to that. Now, we have a good introduction to the character of Susan, who meets Josie on the bus into town, portrayed by Chelsea Starr. And it also makes sense that she could disappear and no one would know, since she isn't from this town, and that works. I even like the story that we get here with Dr. Taylor from the power plant, and he is portrayed by Reeves. Now, I'll reveal here that they are doing something shady, shouldn't shock you. They're not convinced that it's their fault either. There is commentary here about this plant dumping its waste and it influences the environment. I do like the idea. The waste they're leaving is causing the plants to come to life. This feels like it might be borrowing from, like, The Evil Dead and its sequel, where, like, the vines are coming out and attacking people. I'm not going to hold that against this, as vines coming to life and kill and then growing inside of the victim isn't a bad idea, in my opinion. So let's get over some problems here, and this is boring. That's the major problem I have. It doesn't take long to get to that first kill. We're even getting a Jaws-style movie where the leadership of the power plant are trying to cover it up, and they're even working with the police. I like the commentary that comes with that, as the local police might be in on the deal, you know, and helping to cover it up. Interestingly, this also look at capitalism and cunning corners. Disposing of the waste is costly, so they're illegally dumping it. The negative is that this is backloaded while the action from the opening act. How they end this doesn't fully make sense to me, though, either. The problem is they already are there, and they don't necessarily do anything to stop it, in my opinion. I just don't think that this was thought out. The filmmakers probably didn't think anyone would analyze this and just kind of enjoying what we were given. So let's move over to the acting. It's fine across the board. Sellers and Saucier are solid as our two leads. I like that they're investigating things to figure out what is happening. They also feel like a couple that has known each other for years. Reeves is good as a stressed out doctor from the plant. I thought Star was good for what we needed there. Later on, we'll get to meet Patrick Collins' character of Brian, who is an investigative reporter. He's coming to see his grandfather. I thought he was fine in what he does. I like the people in this town. They feel like they just literally cast a small town to play themselves, to be honest. I would also give credit here to Vince O'Neill, who plays the sheriff. We also have Gabrielle Tinty playing a doctor from the plant. He's in charge of the investigation. I thought he was fine. They're all good as villains from there. Bit over the top and mustache twirling. There was one questionable thing near the end, but I'll digress. Also, this filmmaking. This isn't working with the biggest budget, but what we got looked good at times. I'm solid with what they did with the effects. They were done practically, so I credit that. We get some good gore at times. I thought this was shot fine. No glaring issues with the cinematography and how they frame things. It helps hide the seams. Soundtrack was also fine without necessarily standing out. In conclusion, this isn't a good movie, but I knew that coming in. We aren't working with the biggest budget. I like the setting of the small town. The social commentary of capitalism and dumping waste is good. The eco-horror there about the environment fighting back is also solid. Even the precursor with what Josie brings David in is solid writing. The acting, though, is amateur, and the script isn't helping there. This is made well enough, with bright spots with the effects. This is just a bit too slow for my liking. One that I'd recommend to fans of low-budget Italian cinema, I think is actually a step up from Troll 2, in my opinion, even though this one, and this is, well, it's a bit less schlocky, so that's also part of it. So my rating here for The Crawlers is going to be a 5 out of 10. And then another screener I got to watch was going to be a short called Velma. This is from 2022. It was written, directed, and starring Scarlett Moreno. This stars, along with her, Zach Tinker and Byron Rodriguez. This one doesn't have enough ratings on the IMDb page, and on Letterboxd, they're really kind of hovering around a half star. I actually read somewhere that they think it might be because of using one of the main characters from Scooby-Doo, but the synopsis is, through the lens of the 1960s visual feast, this takes us on a psychological journey with a title character that examines sexuality, shame, and our societal views on both. So this is a short that I got the chance to see thanks to Scott Mastisco when he sent over the screener copy for review. Now, I came into this one blind, knowing that this was going to be a horror thriller, at least along those lines. Since this was short, I wanted to see what this had to offer without knowing much. So the synopsis sums this up well. We are following our titular character of Velma, who is portrayed by Moreno. From the opening shots, we see that she's sad. She then has dates with four different guys. Each time, she's hoping it'll be different and what she is looking for. Something happens, though, as it all plays out the same. She is sad each morning. Now, I took a guess that she was killing these guys. I won't reveal if that's the case or not. Whatever is happening, it upsets her. She prepares these lavish meals, and we see that she falls in love with whatever guy she has over. One she even believes to be special and just knows it. That is Tinker, and he's credited as that in the end. This grabbed my attention to see where it would go. As a story guy, there isn't much here to flesh out. Now, she also doesn't necessarily need it either. It is subtle in telling what it needs to. This is more about the visuals, which are stunning. This is paying homage to the 1960s with those visuals, and I agree with the synopsis calling this a feast. The spectrum of color from the food Velma has prepared to even her makeup and what she's wearing, I appreciated that for sure. The soundtrack going along with this is great, including the one song that is reoccurring. How this is made with the cinematography is just, you know, beautiful. So I can't say much more about the acting, but Moreno is great. She doesn't speak, but we get voiceover narration to fill in there. The guys outside of Tinker are shown out of focus, which is interesting. They're the ones who are upsetting Velma, but by being shown fuzzy, they're all the same as she says. They all do the same thing that ruins her vision of them. I did find this to be creative there, and I just realized as I'm doing this that I went back to filmmaking. So there's not much more to say here, so in conclusion, this is a well-made short. The cinematography and the colors are great. I'll even include the framing, limited effects that we get, and the soundtrack there as well. Moreno's performance as Velma is good. Her voice fills in what you need along with the body language of what we're seeing there. There isn't much to the story, but what we've given us, it works. How I normally grade shorts is to whether they can tell a complete story or could be fleshed out to more. I think this does the former, but I'd be fine with the latter if this one decided to be expanded upon. This is one that I enjoyed my time with and recommend seeing if you want to see a visually stunning short. So my rating here for Velma is going to be a 6.5 out of 10. Then my last mini review here is going to be for the next episode of The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Live. This is episode 3 called Bye. And then this was directed by Michael Slovis. And then everything else is pretty much all the same. So what I'll just jump into here is this one starts off years ago. We have the character Pollyanna McIntosh is taken out of Janice Stokes talking to Rick and telling him he can't escape. We also see Michonne fitting in and that Jandis knows her. There's a zombie killed in the turnstile. I just wanted to comment on that because that was actually a good effect there. Now, we see that Rick and Michonne are trying to escape. Plans are made. The CR will kill them, although if he ends up going back there, so that's what he's being warned about. So he can't join, but he creates a way for Michonne to get out. And we actually see that Rick is using Jendis to help make sure that she escapes, but we see that she didn't go. So then she ends up being taken as Pearl Thorn has taken over as the commanding officer for Rick and his unit and everything. So they go on a mission out west, and Michonne doesn't do as she's told, you know, shocker there. And I actually think that Pearl knows there's something up here. So this ends up ending with a pretty shocking thing here where Michonne jumps out of a helicopter in the middle of a storm and everything like that. And it kind of actually shocked me seeing that. So my rating ended up being a 7 out of 10 for this one. Still kind of interesting to see where this goes and where it's going to end up and everything like that. So, like I said, still don't love this one like other people do. And I'm actually, you know, part the way through the next episode, which I will hopefully have for the next one. On my next episode. So what I'm going to go ahead then do is get you over the trailer of my first featured review. For my first featured review here is going to be Dante's Inferno from 1924. This was directed by Henry Otto. This was written by Cyrus Wood and Edmund Golding. So they're actually crediting Wood as doing the original story, and then Golding is doing the adaptation, while Dante Algari is given credit for quotations and also doing the original writing for this. This is starring Lawson Butt, Howard Gay, and Ralph Lewis, while also featuring Pauline Stark, Joseph Swickard, Gloria Gray, William Scott, Robert Klein, Winifred Landis, Lorimer Johnston, Lon Puff, Bud Jameson, Carmen Chita Johnson, Noble Johnson, Diana Miller, and Carrie Clark Ward. This is a drama horror romance film that is from the United States, currently sitting on a 5.7 on IMDb, and not enough ratings on Letterboxd, but I would say 2.5-3 stars over there. With our synopsis being, the tactics of a vicious slumlord and greedy businessman finally drive a distraught man to commit suicide. The businessman is tried for murder, executed, and afterwards swiftly taken by demons to hell, where he will spend the rest of eternity. So this is a movie that I discovered when searching for horror films from 1924. I was able to find a copy on YouTube, so I'm adding this into my Centennial Club for this podcast here. So this is the second earliest adaptation of the source material from Dante that I've seen now, as the other one would have been from 1911 when I was covering that over during Italian Horror Month, because that was, you know, from Italy. I think that was 1911 if I didn't say that either. So let's do some featured notes before I get into the movie itself, and I'll start with our director of Otto, who has directed 13 films. I've only ever seen this one, only one that he's done in genre. Now, we have two writers here. First is Golding. He wrote 43 movies, only one that I've seen, and only one in genre for him. Then our co-writer of Woods did 7 features and 27 shorts. Again, only one that I've ever seen was this, and in genre. I'll also credit Elgari here, a.k.a. Dante. I've seen one of his 6 adaptations, technically. Now, I did cover that other variation here on the podcast. There have been 5 shorts also done on his work. Has one other in horror with Dante's Traum von der Hölle from 1989. Not heard of that version. So moving to the cast, I'll start with Lewis, who has done 84 films and 9 shorts. I've seen 3 with The Birth of a Nation, being not in genre. Has 3 in the genre with The Avenging Conscience, also by D.W. Griffith, as the one that I haven't seen. I did watch him in The Death Kiss with Lugosi, and now this here. Next will be Scott. He has 39 features and 2 shorts. I've seen 2 of his works. Both are in genre with this and Strangers of the Evening. Next will be Scott. He has 39 features and 2 shorts. I've only ever seen 2 of his works. Both are in genre with this and Strangers of the Evening. Then last is Stark. She has 44 films and 3 shorts. I've only ever seen her in this. Did one other one in genre with the Mysterious Island from 1929, which I have not seen that one as of yet. So let's get to this movie here then. We have Mortimer Judd, portrayed by Lewis. He's the father of a family as well as a slumlord. He is convinced that if he isn't ruthless, his family would be in the poorhouse. His wife is Mrs. Judd, portrayed by Landis. They employ a nurse, Marjorie Vernon, portrayed by Stark. Mortimer doesn't seem to think that there's anything wrong with his wife, but that could be him just not wanting to pay for it and thinking that she's kind of, his wife's just faking it. But she also is a doctor of Joseph, portrayed by Johnston. Now, they also, him and his wife have a son of Ernest, portrayed by Scott. He butts heads with his father due to the condition of the apartments that they have. So then they show us a man who is indebted to Mortimer, Eugene Craig, portrayed by Swickard. He sends a letter asking for mercy, but he's denied. This makes him want to kill himself. His daughter Mildred, portrayed by Gray, is concerned he'll do something bad. She then goes to Mortimer to beg, but he ignores her as well. Eugene did send a book to Mortimer, though, Dante's Inferno. He starts to read this, and a fiend portrayed by Klein appears. The book comes alive with Dante being portrayed by Butt, given a tour of the underworld by Virgil, portrayed by Gay. The events of the synopsis then go down where Mortimer is punished for what he's done to these people as one of the apartments catch fire, injuring the tenants. So let's leave my recap introduction of the characters. Where I want to start is prefacing that this version I watched didn't have a soundtrack synced with it. That makes silent films much different without something. I was curious to, as this started, to see how they were going to work with this classic tale. Since the beginning was in a like modern setting, there was some social commentary here that I found intriguing and relevant as well. So let's start with the story that this is following in the commentary. Mortimer is a slumlord. I found it intriguing to explore this idea with a movie that is 100 years old now. I'm not sure if that term was being used when this was made, but Mortimer owns apartments that have too high of rent for what is being provided. This keeps the tenants poor while until the point where they get evicted, and then he just allows someone else new to live there. So there's something that happens here, though, where a fire breaks out, injuring those that live there and making him liable for not helping. This is the climax and the repercussions that follow. So there's another storyline here dealing with Ernest and Mortimer, father and son, not seeing eye to eye. They get into fights when Mortimer is upset that Ernest has a radio. Mrs. Judd can't go out, so the son bought it for her so she could have entertainment. Ernest is interested in Marjorie, but this upsets Mortimer since she is there to tend to his wife. Mortimer believes that if he isn't ruthless, his family is going to spend his money until they're broke. He is exaggerating, while I can also see his side that they don't have an income, so there is a pressure on him as well. So the last part of the story I want to delve into here is I wasn't sure how they were going to connect Dante's poem with the story in the present of this movie. I found it interesting that Mortimer is reading this book that was sent to him from Eugene. It also is interesting that it almost comes with a curse. There is a concept here that I don't love when it's used today for the most part. I did find it interesting here and how it was incorporating in. This feels like it's borrowing from like a Christmas Carol with it. I'm not going to spoil it though beyond that. So I just kind of wanted to, you know, introduce the idea and let you kind of think about that for yourself and, you know, just in case you decide to watch this. So where I want to go then would be acting. Our lead here is Lewis, and I thought he plays this villainous role well. He comes off angry, and every time we see him, he's rude. That works well for what is happening in the end and, you know, where it ends up. I did like Button Gay as Dante and Virgil to set the stage for the different levels of hell. Scott works as Ernest. I like how him, Stark, Landis, and Johnston push what Mortimer does and believes. The same could be said for Swickard and Gray as this other family that come into the story to kind of help change Judd's lives forever. I did have an issue with Bud Jameson was playing the butler. My issue there is that he's white and they made him up in blackface for this role. I don't understand why they just couldn't have a white butler, but I'll digress there. I get it's the time that this is made, but it just doesn't sit well with me. I'd also say that the rest of the cast was solid for what was needed, especially all those playing roles in hell as either demons or those being punished. All that's left them to be filmmaking. I do have an issue and say that the copy that I saw on YouTube was rough. It was too dark to make out some of the details. It made the early title cards hard to see. There's also no soundtrack synced with it. A cleaned up version would be nice, just to kind of give us a true rating. With what I could see, though, I thought that this did well in bringing to life hell. That was great. I also love this fiend that is haunting Mortimer. I guess that it wasn't real, but the implications of it work. The effects that we get in hell were all done in camera, so that's impressive. This was made well enough from what I could see for the era. So there's only one piece of trivia that I was going to do here from the IMDb page. There's an incomplete nitrate print missing reel 2 out of the 5 reels that survives in the UCLA Film and Television Archives, and it's not listed for preservation, which is kind of a shame there that this is probably going to end up falling into, you know, even more obscurity. So in conclusion, this is another early version of the source material that I've seen. What I did enjoy is that we have two different takes on this story. I love studying the story that is relevant today, about a slumlord who is living off his tenants without doing much that could help them. Showing us Dante's vision of hell and then Mortimer being punished was great. I thought the acting was good. The version I saw was rough, but this looked like it was made well enough from what I could tell. There are some story elements here that I don't love now. Using it during this era, though, is still new. Not having a soundtrack sync was a bummer. I'd still recommend this to fans of this era of cinema or looking for the history of the horror genre, just to kind of do what I'm doing, you know, with some, you know, deep dives and whatnot there. So my rating for Dante's Inferno from 1924 is going to be a 7 out of 10. Not going to do a spoiler section. Don't really think there's anything else I need to delve into outside of what I've already given to here. So let me go ahead and get you over to the trailer of my second featured review.
God save me for a reason, but I'm still searching for what that reason is. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Hello? I know God saved me for a reason, but guess I'm still searching for what that reason is.
Too much blood of Christ.
It's a miracle. You are with child.
Out of all the women in the world,
why did he choose me?
How can we trust what's inside you?
Suffering is love.
No one ever.
Suffering, suffering, suffering is love.
And for my second featured review here is going to be Immaculate. This is from here in 2024. This is directed by Michael Moen. This was written by Andrew Lobel. The stars Sydney Sweeney, Alvaro Morti, and Simona Tabasco, while also featuring Benedetta Porcaroli, Giorgio Colagnelli, Dora Romano, Julia Heathfield Di Runzi, Gimpero Giudici, Betty Pazzara, Giuseppe Lo Piccolo, Christina Chilanghi, Niccolo Senni, Isabel De Santis, Viviani Florentine Nicolai, Marcia Regina, Laura Camassa, Cinzi Fantuzzi, and Tinzio Farucci. I think it's how you mispronounce or how pronounce those names. If I mispronounce any, I do apologize. But this is a horror film that is a co-production between Italy and the United States. Currently sitting on a 6.1 on IMDb and a 3.1 on Letterboxd. Our synopsis: Cecilia, a woman of devout faith, is warmly welcomed to the picture-perfect Italian countryside, where she is offered a new role at an illustrious convent. But it becomes clear to her that her new home harbors dark and horrifying secrets. So this is a movie that I saw a bit of the trailer at the Gateway Film Center. I knew that I was going to check this out from that. I'm a fan of religious-based horror films. Seeing the title, I had a feeling this was going to be a play on how the Virgin Mary became pregnant with Jesus. But I was curious as where they would go, and you know, I got to see this open night at the theater, and this is one that I was excited for this year as well. So let's start with some featured notes before I get into the movie, and I'll start with our director of Moen, has 4 films and 2 shorts. I've only ever seen this, only thing he's done in horror to date so far. We have 3 assistant directors. First is going to be Andrea Poggiani. Now, they have 6 movies. I've seen Inferno, which is like the 3rd film in the Da Vinci Code series, and then this, and this is the only one that they've done in horror. Then to Alessandro Specchio, they've done 4 features. I've only ever seen this in Spring, the only 2 they've done in genre as well. Then last is Anna Marie G. Cesare. They have 3 films. Only one that I've seen is this, and the only one that I've done in horror. Then to the writer, this is their feature film debut for Lobel. The next to the cast, I'll start with Sweeney. She has 34 films and 3 shorts. I've seen 4 of her works. I've seen her in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That isn't in horror. She has 8 in the genre, and I've seen 3. I have now seen this, The Ward from John Carpenter, and Zombies of Mass Destruction. I have not seen Nocturne, Night Teeth, or Dead Aunt as the top 3. Then our co-star of Morti has 14 films. I've only ever seen this one. Has 2 in genre with this and La Pesadilla from 2022. Then lastly, I'll look at Porcaroli, who has 14 films and 1 short. The only one that she has done in horror and that I have seen from her. So then, we start this off with a nun saying her prayers before bed. She has other plans, though. She has packed a bag and snuck into the Mother Superior's room and taken a set of keys from a nightstand. She sneaks out of the convent, but as she is passing through a gate, we see a searchlight come on. Now, our nun tries to make a run to the gate, and she is chased by a group in masks. We see what happens, though, when they catch her, and it isn't pleasant. So then we shift this over to Sister Cecilia, who is portrayed by Sweeney, as she's coming to Italy. She is held up by 2 customs officials. It is here that we learn that she's from America and came with no return ticket, so this is a red flag. We will learn that her parish is closed, and she is offered a spot here by Father Sal Tedeschi, portrayed by Morti. Now, something to point out here is the custom officials make comments about her looks. They question her resolve to be a nun, but she is devout in her choice. She is then taken to the convent. It is there that she meets Mother Superior, portrayed by Romano, and Sister Isabel, portrayed by Di Renzi. Now, the latter dislikes her and makes it known. Now, she is pushing for Cecilia to return to America. Our lead also meets Sister Gwen, portrayed by Porcaroli. Now, she had a rough life before taking the vows that we will learn through just different conversations. So that night, as she is taking her vows, and that would be Cecilia, she meets Father Tedeschi. He takes a liking to her and helps translate. It is from there that we see Cecilia befriend Gwen and settle in. That is until she gets sick while bathing. She is examined by Dr. Gallo, portrayed by Giudicia, and questioned by Cardinal Franco Merola, portrayed by Colagni. Now, they grill her about fulfilling her vows and if they've had any visitors to the convent. The reason being is that Cecilia is pregnant. They confirm that she's a virgin and that this is a miracle. Things don't seem right, and Gwen pushes this. The more that Cecilia learns, the more that she thinks her friend could be right. So I think it's where I leave my recap introduction of the characters. Where I want to start is that I'm a big fan of this subgenre, as I've alluded to in my opening. There are good elements here. It feels like we're borrowing from Suspiria with part of it. That hit me while in the theater. Now, something else to point out in the opening, this explores elements of science versus religion that works well for me on top of all of that. So now that I've said that, let me delve a bit deeper. I'll start with the Suspiria references. We have Sister Cecilia coming from America to Italy, much like Susie Banyan did. Instead of going to a dance academy, she is joining this convent. We also have her befriending someone who is suspicious of those in charge and investigating. Cecilia doesn't believe but discovers things for herself, and that makes her change her thoughts to what she was, you know, told by her friend. There are also secrets being held here as well. That's kind of the surface level stuff. Then pulling directly, I did want to say that. So let's go over to the idea of science versus religion. We learn here that Cecilia almost died as a child in an accident with ice. She was clinically dead for 7 minutes. She felt that there was a divine intervention to bring her back. Now, personally, I'm an atheist. To me, this just seems like the paramedics did their job with a bit of luck. Father Tedeschi was a biologist before becoming a priest. I'm glad that that got introduced because it plays in later. There's also the main thing here about Cecilia becoming pregnant despite being a virgin. It makes you wonder if there was a miracle or if there's something else at play here. I like how it takes time for the reveal, as this does have vibes of like Rosemary's Baby minus the rape scene. Cecilia does become lightheaded and passes out her first night there, though. The next bit is under the surface, and that social commentary that I saw someone else include in their review. We can view this as a debate about pro-life versus pro-choice. Cecilia didn't have a choice in getting pregnant. She is told by the convent that it's a miracle, so she must carry the child. The more that she learns, though, the more she wants to be rid of it. She isn't given a choice in this, so you can argue that it's a rape, whether there is a logical answer or a divine one. Where this ends up is brutal, and I'm shocked there that it went, to be honest. That should be enough for the story, so let's go over to the acting. I thought that Sweeney turned in a good performance. I'm not overly familiar with her. I find her attractive, and that seems to be part of why she was cast, and that works, though. She also does a great job of showing a range of emotions as she learns the truth of her condition. I appreciated that. Morty was good as this priest that we can trust in the beginning. The more that we learn, the more we question his motives. I like poor Caroli as Cecilia's friend. She starts making her question things, which is good. Colagni, Romano, Di Renzi, and the rest of the nuns, as well as the patients of this convent, were good for what was needed. There's a creepy factor there, since the place is almost like the church's hospice, where there's a lot of these patients here are sent here to die. It's fitting that Cecilia becomes pregnant here. Now, all that's left then is filmmaking, and then a little bit of trivia. First, I would have to say is I love the setting. This isolated convent is good. Characters can't just leave, so it's that isolation adds to the tension. This is shot well. Thought the cinematography was good. How they frame things work. This does rely on jump scares, and I don't necessarily know if we need them, as this isn't that type of movie, which is kind of weird, because this is more about like the story and building on that, and then that atmosphere. The effects, though, were good. We see things that made me cringe, so credit to that. The blood looks good. There's also that ghost place I wasn't expecting. Lastly, it's the soundtrack. Thought this was good to fit the tone. It helps build that atmosphere. I would be remiss if I didn't give credit here, because they used Bruno Nicolai's theme for The Red Queen Dies 7 times. When I heard it, I couldn't place it immediately, but it's a song that I know quite well, because I actually have listened to the song a lot of times while writing, even though I've never actually seen that giallo film. So then there's some limited trivia on the IMDb page that I wanted to share here. It sounds like Sweeney auditioned for this film in 2014, so, you know, 10 years ago, but the project never materialized. Years later, she took the role of a producer and reached out to the writer, acquired and revised the script, hired a director, found financiers, and sold the film to Neon, which is amazing that I didn't even realize that she spearheaded this one getting made, which I see that she kind of bounces back and forth into the genre, so that makes me happy to hear. It looks like the director previously worked with Sweeney in the movie Voyeurs from 2021 and the show Everything Sucks from 2018. And then we also have Sweeney and Tabasco have both appeared in The White Lotus, but haven't shared scenes over there, so it's kind of a little interesting bit with that. So, in conclusion, I like what this movie's doing. I wasn't sure the route they would take. The setting is good by having this isolated convent like this. The concepts and ideas explored are solid. I like that there's some social commentary that you can pull in here, but this isn't in your face. Sweeney was good along with Morty. No issues with any of the acting performances. This is well made, from the cinematography to the effects and the soundtrack. This one shot up into my top 5 for the year for the horror genre. I will be giving this a rewatch to see how I sit a second time around, you know, before compiling the end of year list. So I'm not going to do a spoiler section. I don't think I necessarily need to do anything there. So let me get you over to one last break before I close out this show. Should actually probably get my rating, though. I actually just realized I didn't. So for Immaculate, I give this one an 8 out of 10 as well. So then let me get you over then, as I was saying. And welcome back one last time here. And just to kind of go through my social medias and stuff, if you'd like to send me an email, you can send that at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. You can send me any sort of feedback, or if you have any questions or anything, go ahead and shoot them there, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Or if you want to send me any screener links or anything like that, anything podcast-related, you can send it via that way. If you'd like to read any of the written reviews, I'll direct you to Reviews of the Dead, and that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, I'm David Michigan Garrett Jr. On Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, I'm David OSU. On Instagram, I'm DavidOSU87. On Threads, I'm DavidOSU87. And then Journey with a Cinephile has its own Instagram at Journey with a Cinephile, all one word. Now, all of these ones I will be sharing, like, my ratings on, whatnot. I know for Letterboxd, all of the reviews are going to be for horror and non-horror alike. Instagram, I will be sharing over there is my different, like, posters and everything for things that I'm reviewing. My personal account, you might see some personal pictures every now and then if I can remember to take them. And then, you know, kind of same thing for Threads. And then Journey with a Cinephile is going to be more of just kind of posting podcast-related different stuff over there. And I'll also direct you to the Nightclub Discord channel, as I have a little section over there where we have some good conversations. I post all of my reviews and any new podcast episodes or some of the things I'm watching when I actually have time to post that. So keep an eye out over there, and I'll have the link for that and everything else in the show notes there. And then I'm also going to direct you, if a way that you can actually listen to the show is going to be through the PodNation TV. This is a streaming service and everything like that. There'll be a link in the blog posts for all of my episodes, so if you'd like to listen to it that way, it's kind of a cool little thing. You can definitely do that through like Roku TV, and there's some other apps for it as well, just as another way for you to consume this podcast if you decide to. And there's also a lot of other great shows that are on that network as well. And for my next episode, it is going to be my last of the Centennial Club for this year, as the 1924 movie I'm going to be watching is Alita, the Queen of Mars. And then for the movie I'm going to be pairing that up with, I'm curious as how this is going to work as a double feature, is Late Night with the Devil. I actually had been stressed out at work, so I took Friday off and lucked out that they're showing this movie, I think at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so I'm going to go see it. And then my Foray Through the Forest rewatch is going to be It's Alive from 74. I'm also going to watch He Who Gets Slapped. This is a Lon Chaney movie that appeared for like a day or so on Letterboxd as a horror movie from 1924. So I'm at least going to watch it just to kind of see if it falls into the genre or not. And it might end up, you know, not. I might even give a little mini review. We'll see what happens there. I also am going to be going back to the Gateway Film Center to watch Memories of Murder. Never seen this movie, the South Korean one. I've heard really good things about it. And I'm also going to try to see if I can fit in Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. And I also have a screener of a movie called Dagger that comes out on April 1st, so I'm going to be trying to throw that on there as well as another, you know, movie that I'll be watching for that. So I think that should be enough here for this outro. So I will say in closing is whatever you do today, hope you're safe and doing, have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr., and I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening, and what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.